Okay, hello everybody. The next talk is by Alistair Kurgan, the maintainer of LVM, Logical Volume Management. So, welcome, Alistair.
Okay, you can all hear me and not too loud? No. How many people here were also listening to Heinz's talk just before this? So, little over half. Okay, so I will cover some of the same things then for the benefit of the people who weren't. Okay, I'm going to talk about logical volume management. Who has used LVM? Who knows what LVM is? Okay, almost everybody. I'll go through the first bit very quickly then. So, as you can see on the slides, volume management creates a layer of abstraction over the physical storage. Physical volumes are combined into volume groups. So that's introducing the terminology which you're probably familiar with, PV, VG, LV for the logical volumes. So basically, it's a little bit like partitioning. Your logical volumes are like your disk partitions. The advantages, of course, you can have a file system that extends over more than one disk. Because the hardware storage configuration is hidden from the software, you can change it in real time. So that's what PV Move lets you do. It lets you move your data from one disk to another while it's still being used. So if you have a disk that you want to take out of your machine, but it's still got some data on it, you no longer have to shut down all the applications and file systems using that disk first. You can move the data somewhere else while it's being used. And then when the disk is now empty, you can then take the disk out. And we also have snapshots. Who's used snapshots? Ah, not so many people. Right, I'll say a bit more about those then. One of the advantages of a snapshot freezes your data in time. It gives you a copy of what the data looked like at a particular instant in time. So you have your file system or your applications are writing to the file system and you decide you want to back up your file system. Now if you just run something like tar on your live file system, tar will start copying the files here in the tree and it'll move all around the tree, but your files are changing while tar is running. So you don't have an instantaneous copy of your file system. For example, if tar is backing up this part of your directory tree here, and then it backs up this bit here, meanwhile, you move a file from somewhere it hasn't backed up yet over to somewhere it has already backed up, you decided to do a move just at that point, tar won't back up the file. So it backed up the files, the first files before that point, and then it backs these others afterwards, but your file got moved in such a way that it was missed. So if you take a snapshot, what happens is it issues a sync to the file system. It tells the file system, I'm about to do a backup. Please make sure your metadata is consistent. Flush to disk. So it syncs. Then when it's synced, it takes a virtual copy. At that point in time, it starts recording all the changes you make to the file system. It just records the changes. Then it lets the I.O. flow again. It lets the rest of the applications run. So you just have a very short period of time in which it says the snapshot happens now, and then everything that changes after that point is recorded. And it takes a copy of the original data whenever you change something. So if you change a file after you've made a snapshot, it stashes away a copy of what it used to look like. So it can reconstruct the file system. It can make your block device look like how it did when you created the snapshot at that instant. And so the backup sees a consistent copy of the file system. Right, device mapper, this is what Heinz covered to a large extent in the previous talk. But what we've done in LVM2 is separate out user space, metadata, logical volumes, volume groups, physical volumes. These are all user space concepts now. In the kernel, we just have a very small set of concepts, the minimum we think we need in order to support volume management. So on the kernel side, our unit of space is a sector, and a sector is 512 bytes by definition for us. And all sizes are measured in terms of 512 bytes when we are communicating with device mapper. In user space, we have a thing called a physical extent or a logical extent, and that is our smallest amount of space we will allocate to a logical volume. And that extent might be 4 megabytes, you might make it bigger, you might have 16 megabytes, you can choose. But as far as the kernel's concerned, we just work in terms of a 512-byte sector. And that's one example of how we do something generically in the kernel, make it very simple, we make one decision, size will be measured in sectors, and we apply that throughout. Whereas in user space, you're worried about the convenience. If you measure size in sectors, you have some very big numbers. So in user space, it's useful to have a concept of an extent, which is larger, and then you can say my disk is 1,000 extents in size or 100,000 extents, but it's easier to manage. So this is a quick diagram showing how we have device mapper in the kernel, which I'll expand on in a later slide. In user space, we have here two volume managers, LVM2 and EVMS. EVMS talks directly through the interface, an IOCTL interface, to the kernel device mapper, whereas LVM2 works through a library called libdevmapper. And again, this is another layer of abstraction. Libdevmapper tries to hide all the details of the device mapper interface from user space applications. So libdevmapper knows all the details. It knows that sizes have to be in sectors and the table strings have to be in this particular format and so on. Whereas LVM2 can say to libdevmapper, I need a device which is striped this size and those are the devices going onto the stripe. And libdevmapper will work out how to communicate that information to device mapper. The other thing libdevmapper does is cope with different versions of the kernel. Libdevmapper checks to see what version of device mapper you have in the kernel and adapts accordingly. So if LVM2 wants to use some fairly new feature in the kernel and libdevmapper finds that the kernel doesn't support that new feature, but libdevmapper knows how to implement something very similar using an older version. So maybe the new version lets you do something in a single IOCTL call. So one IOCTL from libdevmapper to device mapper with a new kernel will do something. But with an old kernel, you might need 4 IOCTLs to do the same thing. Well, libdevmapper will work that out and do those 4 IOCTLs instead. So libdevmapper is what allows us to use different versions of the kernel, so you can boot to a different kernel and not have to keep changing your user space tools every time you change your kernel. It tries to hide all the complexity of versioning inside libdevmapper. And one consequence of that is the libdevmapper code looks quite ugly. If you ever look at the code in libdevmapper, it goes around in loops at times and does some very strange things. converting one call into four calls in some cases and saying, oh, we need this new parameter. We don't know the value of this parameter. We'll have to do some more calls to the kernel to work out what it should be and fill it in. Whereas with a new kernel, you don't need that parameter. Okay, this is the kernel side. The diagram is now with user space at the top, but these diagrams are so difficult to draw in OpenOffice, I'm not changing it. If someone can point me at a nice tool that makes it easy to draw diagrams like this, then speak to me afterwards, but I don't know one. User space applications up here, they go in through the IOCTL interface into Device Mapper. We used to have a file system interface, but for various reasons it's not been maintained and it's very difficult. There's a lot more code necessary for a file system interface than an IOCTL interface, surprisingly. So we have the control commands. So these are things saying, create a block device. Give me a new device with this mapping, or destroy this device. Then the interface over here is for the actual I/O itself. So the I/O here is when you are writing a piece of I/O or reading something from disk, that comes in down this side. So that's a separate entry point. And then we have what I've called core device mapper, and these are the generic functions, how to create a device, destroy a device, process I/O, QIO, they all go in here. Then we have different targets and mappings, of which Heinz's DM RAID 415 target is one. Simple linear target just passes I/O straight through to another part of another device. Mirroring. Snapshots, multipath, and some of the infrastructure that then plugs into the multipath target. Snapshots and mirrors both use a copying facility called kcopyd, and this is an asynchronous interface where we say to kcopyd, please copy this data from here to here and tell us when you're finished. So we just give kcopyd jobs. We say to it, copy this data, please. And it will take a single source and multiple destinations. So if you have four devices in your mirror, you can read from the first device and write to the other three. And kcopyd handles that. Map device is the terminology we use. It gets very confusing because mapped device is abbreviated to MD. And this is not the same as MD multi-disk. So you have to be aware of the context. And DM stands for device mapper. And you have to be careful not to get the letters the wrong way round because it means something else. It's very strange. So the map device, again, repeating what Heinz said, you have the table saying how to map a range of logical sectors from one place to another, and it uses these mapping tables. You can have very large mapping tables if you want. The tools seem to handle them okay now. And you can write your own modules and just plug them into the architecture. So, snapshots, writable snapshots. So as I was saying earlier, it captures the state of a device. The first time a block is changed, it has to take a copy of the original data. So in future, it can reconstruct the device. And then other examples, you might want to run FSCK on a snapshot to find out whether you do need to do FSCK on the real file system or not. So if you think you might have a file system problem but you're not sure, you take a snapshot, you run a practice FSCK on the snapshot, and if it found errors, you know you're going to need an outage to take your file system offline and run FSCK on the real file system. But if it finds no errors, you know you don't need to. You save yourself the outage. Similarly, if you have a production environments, you're running some important applications, and you're about to update the data on those applications, you might want to have a practice first and check what the data will look like after you've done the update. But you don't want to do the real update yet in case there's a problem. So you take a snapshot, you apply the update to the snapshot, check that it's worked how you thought it would, and then if it's okay, you run the updates on the real data. So normally you've got your real disks here, a logical volume here, and there's some I/O going through to the disk. This is the sequence of events necessary to create a snapshot. So this is what happens when you say lvcreate minus s. It then creates another device, copy on write area. This will hold the original copy of data that has changed. So this is holding what has changed. So we create a device for that as well. And it's just a logical volume like the other logical volume. We allocate some space for it. And then we insert some clever snapshot mapping layers. So the things from the previous slide have moved down here. And we create a new mapped device for the origin. And this is going to be in place of the logical volume. So your applications, your file system, will be writing through this origin here. And the snapshot device is what you look at if you want to reconstruct the original data, see how the device used to look. So if we are reading, we can just read through the reading from the origin, we can just read the data directly from the logical volume and through to the underlying disks. Nothing changes if we're reading a block from the origin. But if we want to read a block from the snapshot, well, this module here, this block here, has got to decide, has the data changed or not? So it might be able to just read it straight through from the logical volume here, because nothing's changed yet. But we're now going to make a change. We're going to write to the origin. So our application is writing to the same place as it was writing to before, after the snapshot's created. Well, we intercept the write. Before the write proceeds, we tell the snapshot piece that we're about to do a write. And the snapshot says, hold on, I need to make a copy of that data before you change it. So the snapshot reads the data through the logical volume 1 and writes it a copy of it out to the copy on write area. So it keeps a copy of it here. And then when it's finished, it tells the origin, okay, I've done that, you can carry on now. And so then the write to the origin can proceed through to the original logical volume. But we've got a copy of what it used to look like here. So that's a summary showing the relationship on the same slide with all the arrows, the reads and the writes between the different pieces. So remember, we've got four mapped devices here. So we're using four block devices, four major and minor numbers there. Now let's say we write to the snapshot. Well, all writes to the snapshot go to this special copy on write area. If we'd already written to it in that place, we'd just overwrite the data. Equally, if we hadn't written, it means next time we write to the origin, we won't need to make a copy because we've already changed the place. And there's one complication this slide doesn't show, and that is that we use what we call a chunk size. We use a small unit of data, and any write that is smaller than that unit grows to that particular size. So a typical chunk size might be 16K, 16 kilobytes. And if you have 16 kilobytes, if you write 1K, it treats it as if it was 16K. So the index over here works in units of 16K. So if you write 1K here, it will copy 16K, that includes that 1K, over here. And then there's a copy of the whole of that 16K. And that snapshot size is configurable. Just don't choose the maximum value at the moment, or your kernel will oops. But as long as you don't choose 1024K on a normal Intel machine, you'll be all right. But if you choose that size, then you get an oops. If you reading the change snapshot, of course, as I said, it can now get read from the copy and write area. So the summary of the single snapshot is like that. Then if you have two snapshots, you have the whole thing happening again on the other side. So the data gets copied twice at the moment. So if you have 10 snapshots, you have 10 copies of the changes. So it doesn't scale. The current design doesn't scale. You can have a few snapshots, but you can't have a large number. There are some other designs in the offing which improve that, but we've not had very much time to work on them. So I always put my hands up in horror when I see people on the mailing list saying I've got 30 snapshots. I think you must have a lot of memory for these to work, because the index table of what is stored in here has to be held in memory all the time. It can't be swapped. It has to be in physical memory. So you can, if you have lots of snapshots, you very quickly run out of memory. Then we have mirror. I'll skip over this because Heinz covered a more sophisticated version of it. So the mirror target is, like we say, keeping identical copies of data. And the key thing, again, we divide it into regions. In this case, the regions are much larger than the regions we use for snapshots. Typically 512K, but you can go into megabytes if you want. But we have a little log with one bit for every region. So it's very tiny, but it knows whether the regions are identical on the two disks at any instant or not. So if I want to change the data, I have to first tell the log I'm changing this bit. So you set a bit to say these two devices might not be identical here in this region because I'm about to change them. And then you write to both of them. When both of them have been written to, you can then clear the bit and say, okay, they're identical again now. And that's how we cope if we lose power in the middle of the operation. When the machine comes back up, it knows which bits of the disk are consistent and which bits of the mirror aren't, and have to be, the data has still to be copied back again. So we use it for PV move. So this automated move of data while the system is writing to the device. And so PV move works very simply. We have two disks. This is the old where the data used to be. This is where we want to move it to, over here. So we put a mirror in the middle. So any reads come from the left-hand side. All the reads come from here because this one is not a copy yet. The mirror here is reading from here and writing back to there. So it's doing the copy. And when it's finished, the two disks will be identical. You can take the mirror out and you're just left with this afterwards. And then you can free this space and use it for something else. So I mentioned about LibDevMapper earlier. Some of the other tools, DMRAID, Heinz mentioned, we've got multipath tools for managing the multipath target. DM setup is the, if you like, the management program. It provides command line access to the IOCTLs. So anything you can do in a device mapper IOCTL, you can do from the command line using DM setup. So it's useful for testing, and on occasions you may want to use it as for setting up your own devices rather than writing your own program using LibDevMapper or something else. You can do it often with DM setup. So it's mostly used for testing. typical LVM commands. You say you're all LVM users, so you probably know about these. PVcreate to format a device for LVM so that it knows this is a device that I can put a volume group on. VGcreate to create a volume group. LVcreate to create a logical volume. VGChange to activate logical volumes in volume groups. LVChange activates a single logical volume. VGChange says for each logical volume in the volume groups you have listed, and if, in this case I haven't listed any, so it means every. So it says for each logical volume in every volume group, run LVChange-AY on that logical volume. So VGChange is now just a wrapper around LVChange. And a lot of the tools are like that. They have relations to each other. So, for example, we have VGExtend to make a volume group bigger. VGReduce makes it smaller. LVExtend makes a logical volume larger. LVReduce makes it smaller. But we now have LVResize, and LVResize will make it either bigger or smaller depending on what parameters you give it. So when you run LVExtend, it just calls LVResize. And when you run LVReduce, it just calls LVResize. So a lot of the tools are related to each other now. VGScan and PVScan do the same thing internally. They just give you different outputs. And neither of them is strictly necessary anymore. The idea is they go out and probe your devices and search for any volume groups. But if you were to run VGChange-AY, well, it would do that now. It will go out and probe for any volume groups anyway. So VGScan isn't really necessary, but there may be a few cases where you have to run it just because it hasn't, some other operation hasn't updated the internal cache properly or something. Then the main ones for querying devices are now LVs, PVs, and VGs. How many people are aware of those three commands? LVs, PVs? Yeah, not very many. How many know about VG display, LV display? Yeah, a lot more people. Yeah. These are the new ones, and these work more like LS or PS. They give you columns of output, and they're configurable. You can choose what columns you want. So you get one row of output per object being reported. So one row per logical volume. And you can specify which columns of data you want in there. I may have some examples of that later on. I put some documentation for that on the DVD for the conference. I should say there will be a newer version of that documentation going up onto the website now after the conference, and at some point I'll include it in the distribution itself. The aim is to try and get a nice complete document on LVM now. It's about time we had one. There are man pages, there's a how-to, there's Google. But everything is documented somewhere, except metadata. I've never documented metadata, and that's what this is doing for the first time, the next few slides. It's not documented anywhere unless you read the source code. But I will be writing proper documentation over the next few months. These are the technical definitions now. A physical volume is an ordered list, without an S on, of raw device segments. So a segment of a device, a contiguous piece of device, and it's a list of some of those. So you can have gaps in it. So the physical volume, if you think of Dev HDA, it could be the first 1,000 sectors, then there might be a gap, then there could be another 1,000 sectors. That's the definition of physical volume now. The tools don't completely support gaps yet, but the metadata itself does. So it was seen as something useful to add in future, because it may be you've got some bad sectors in the middle of your disk you want to skip past, or it might be you've got another partition in the middle that you want to skip over, and you just want to discard your partition table, but use device mapper to pretend you've still got another partition there. So anyway, the on-disk format allows you to have these things, but the tools don't yet. A volume group is an unordered list of physical volumes and logical volumes, together with, well, the logical volumes implies mappings onto the physical volumes. A logical volume is an ordered list, I've copied that, cut and paste that S, I think, of segments of a logical volume. And a segment is a mapping applied to an ordered list of PV segments or LV segments. So it doesn't matter if you can't get your head around all that at this stage, but those are the definitions I'm working with. And at some point, PVs and LVs will sort of merge because they're very similar internally. You can create a logical volume, and it's a block device. It's a disk. It could be a PV. You could make your logical volume into a PV, and then you could add that PV to another volume group. So you could stack LVM on top of LVM. And at the moment, if you do that, you have to do what I say. You have to create a logical volume, turn it into a physical volume, and then create a new volume group on top. But why do you want two volume groups that are actually pointing at the same data? The volume group is really about allocation. It's about how have I grouped this space together. See, the reasoning behind this is, say you've got a lot of disks. Some of your disks are fast, and some of your disks are slow. So you might want to group together all your slow disks into a group, and all your fast disks into a group. And then when you allocate a logical volume, you'd say, allocate this logical volume on my fast disks. Allocate this logical volume on my slow disks. Now, to do that today, you have to have one volume group for your fast disks and another volume group for your slow disks. Another example, if you were mirroring, you might mirror some of your disks, but not others. So you might have some storage that is mirrored and other storage that is not mirrored. Again, you could put those in different volume groups and then say, allocate this logical volume out of my mirrored volumes, or allocate this one out of my non-mirrored ones. So it's all about management and how do I group them together. And so thinking in those terms, when you allocate the space once to make the mirror, you can then be allocating again onto some space you've already allocated once. So your file system is going through two levels of allocation. And at the moment, you have to have two different volume groups to do that. But there's no reason why it has to be in two separate volume groups. In future, I'd like you to be able to stack allocations within a single volume group. This means you'd have multiple allocation maps within the single volume group. But it would mean the command lines would be simpler. You wouldn't have to do the PV create all the time. You'd get rid of that layer. So on disk, what does metadata look like? Okay. You have one sector at the start of every PV, I say near the start of every PV, holding the label. And this is the piece that identifies this as a device that that can be used by LVM. It just takes one sector. That sector consists of a header, which points to the label data. Now, this is another level of abstraction, which means we can keep the label definition, but if we need to, but we can change the label data if we need to increase the version or support different types of layout, but it can still be recognized with the same label. So we put an extra layer of abstraction in here. And the label data points to the metadata areas and the data areas. So this is telling you where the metadata is on the disk, so where LVM information about logical volumes is stored, and it also tells you where the data is, where is the actual disk space that can be allocated. So the metadata area itself has a header. Again, it's just one sector, and it points to the metadata, which normally follows immediately after it, and there's a little problem here. And the metadata itself is stored in a circular buffer. So new metadata is written after old metadata, and when it runs out of space, it just goes back to the beginning and overwrites the old one. So you've got archived copies of your older versions of your metadata, just in case you lose it. You've got the extra copy you can find there. So the label itself, so that label is placed in the second sector by default, sector number one. And that is because the first sector is used by things like partition table, booting code, and we just wanted to keep out of the way of that. You can put it in the first sector if you want. The tools will scan for the first four sectors. So you can put it in any of the first four sectors. So it should be compatible with bootloaders. It has the string label 1. So if you lose your data, you want to scan disks to see where things are, you're looking for a string called label 1. And interestingly, it contains the sector number. So if you've written it to the first sector, it will say sector 0. If you've written it to the second, it will say sector 1. And it checks that that matches the sector it found the label in. And if it doesn't match, it ignores it. So this helps you cope if your partition if you need to reconstruct a partition table, you can work backwards to see where the device starts by seeing what the sector number is in there. It has a checksum offset, and the label type is LVM2 space 001, first version of it for LVM2. So again, you'll see that string near the beginning of a disk. The label data, this is where we store the unique identifier for the physical volume. We also store the size of the device, and this helps us detect when devices have been resized. I use it mostly for testing. It lets me pretend I've got enormous devices when I haven't, but I can practice. Then a list of the data areas and the metadata areas. And these locations are stored as an offset. How far into the disk is it, and how big is it? And there's room for about 15 locations. I forget the exact number, but you just divide it into 512 bytes. When you've filled up your 512, you've got to stop. But at the moment, we only use 3. You're allowed to have 1 data area and up to 2 metadata areas. And if you have 2 metadata areas, it puts 1 at the beginning of the disk and 1 at the end. Because the most common corruption is somebody overwriting the beginning of a disk by mistake. And if they do that, you've still got a copy of the metadata at the end if you configured it with 2 copies. If you use something like MD, MD puts its metadata near the end of a device. The metadata area itself has a header, again, checksum, a magic number, a version number to say what version of metadata area it is, start byte of the header, so how many bytes into the disk is it where the, or I think it's how many bytes within the metadata area is it where the metadata actually starts. Is that right? No, sorry, it is the start byte for the header itself. Yeah, and this is so that if you're scanning to look for one of these metadata areas later and you find one, you can check what device it belongs to. So if you had a loopback device that is the data for it is inside a file system on another block device, and you scan that underlying block device, you will find a metadata area that doesn't belong to the block device you're scanning. It belongs to something that's mounted through loopback, etc., etc. And by checking the start byte, you can tell whether it's part of the device you're scanning or whether it's part of something else. The size, gone back again, the offset size and checksum and so on. In order to change metadata, in every metadata area attached to the volume group, so by default it puts a copy of the metadata on every disk in your volume group. So if you have 3 disks, you will have 3 copies of the metadata. If you have 100 disks, you will have 100 copies of the metadata. That's not very efficient. Every time you change it, every time you read it, it will read 100 copies and check they're all identical. And if you look at the tools, they actually read it several times at the moment because the caching isn't finished. So you'll find they've read it several hundred times. They've read and processed the metadata and decided it's okay and all identical. So if you have lots of disks, you're advised only to put the metadata on some of them, and you can configure that in pvcreate. When you run pvcreate, you can say how many copies of the metadata you want. So when we want to change it, we write the new metadata into the circular buffer after the existing metadata, and then we store into the header for the metadata area the fact that we've just written it and where the new metadata will start. But it's still new metadata, it's not lived yet, not in use yet, but we put it there. And we do this for every one of those metadata areas. So this is the slow part of the process, getting the metadata prepared, writing it out. So we've done all that, and we now want to actually commit it. We want to make this metadata used. So the first thing we do is we convert the metadata into a device mapper table through libdevmapper. So we load it. That means we do all the memory allocations in the kernel. So we get all the kernel memory allocations done, but we don't activate it yet. We're now ready to activate it, so we sync the device and suspend any more I.O. to it. So any new I.O. coming in has to wait until we finish this process. And we then commit the metadata by writing a single sector. We just have to write one sector to each of our devices where the metadata area header is, saying the live metadata is now here. So we just move that pointer to say in the circular buffer to move it forward and say this is where the metadata is now. So the commit happens when that one sector is written to the first metadata area, moving that pointer. That is the point when the metadata is committed. And then we unsuspend the map device and I.O. can continue flowing. So basically it's as close to an atomic change as we can get. I think I may have another slide, yeah. The metadata has a version number, a generation number in it. And every time we change it, we increment this number. So if the commit operation gets aborted, if the power is lost on the machine, when it comes back up, it might see generation 2, generation 2, generation 3. When it reads the metadata, it says, I've got different versions of it. It knows to use the version number that's largest. It will use generation 3. But before it uses it, it will make sure that those other two have got updated. And because it's an update, it increments the generation number again. So it will write out a copy of what was generation 3 as generation 4, and it will write it to all three. And only when it's written to all three will it then activate. The metadata itself is just stored as ASCII now. So it's readable, it's editable very easily. You can use VGCFG backup and VGCFG restore to take it from the on-disk format with the binary headers, put it into a file in your file system, edit it in your file system, and then put it back onto the disk. And that's all that the LVM2 tools are actually doing. They're reading the text in. They're applying some transformations to that text according to the commands, LV change, LV extend. They're editing it, and then they're just writing that text metadata back out. So I mentioned about that. That's the option to decide how many copies of the metadata you want. And you can also specify how big the metadata is. The default size is too small. It's fine for home computers, but if you're running something on a production server, you've got lots of disks, you need to make it bigger. And at some point, I'll get round to making that more easily configurable. Sort of data center mode, and it'll just make all the defaults 100 times bigger or something. And there are some other flags to do with manipulating the metadata. That's what it looks like. You might have seen that in etc LVM backup. It leaves a copy of the current metadata in etc LVM backup directory. VGConvert lets you change from one format of metadata to another. You can actually run LVM from the text files. You can have disks with no metadata areas on them at all and just have it all in text files if you want. It's no good if you put your root file system on LVM, but it may be okay for other circumstances. And it'll also convert from the old LVM1 metadata format and out of the GFS pool volume management format. So these are some of the enhancements that were made compared to LVM1. So just running very quickly, the main one is that we build it all as a single binary now, and we just look at argv0. You can even write LVM scripts with the hash pling USR bin, no, sbin LVM, and then you can have LV change, LV create, put all your LVM commands in a little script. That was done because it's easy to do, not because it's ever going to be useful. Because you can't do any variable manipulation or anything in it, so you'd be much better off using a shell. But it does have an advantage of speed, because it can cache information from one command to the next. It doesn't throw it away and then reload the binary and have to work it all out again. It can cache. Logging is also very customizable now. You can decide where you want the logs to go. Filtering. Debian made a mess of this, actually. If you use Debian, dev CD-ROM is sometimes not a CD-ROM. It's a disk for some people. And I don't know why the Debian installer gets this wrong or doesn't make it easy to reconfigure. So a lot of Debian people find bits of LVM don't work properly, and it can't see one of their disks. And it can't see the disk because it's configured to ignore the CD-ROM. It doesn't look for a volume group on the CD-ROM. But their system says the CD-ROM isn't a CD-ROM, it's a real disk. So that's a very common problem. Mentioned some of those before. There's a lot of locking now internally. All the objects get locked. And then tagging. I'll say a little bit about tagging, I think. There's an internal cache of the metadata, but it doesn't do very much yet. When I get the cache finished, it will speed the tools up considerably, because they will read the metadata once and then just keep it in memory and use it. At the moment, they throw it away just in case something else changed it. And then they read it again next time they need it. And really, it should be tied to the lock. If it's got a volume group locked, then it knows nobody else will be changing that metadata, so it doesn't need to read it. It can use the cached version. Four allocation policies now: contiguous, normal, which is the default one, anywhere will just find any space anywhere to allocate. So it'll put two stripes on the same disk. If you have one disk and you say dash dash alloc anywhere, you can put both stripes on the same disk, and then it'll be jumping backwards and forwards along the disk all the time. If you're desperate, it'll let you do it. It's not a default. But you can imagine, if you're losing a hard disk which has a stripe on, you might want to do an emergency move of that data somewhere else. You don't care about performance. You just want it moving out of the way quickly. So it might be useful. Every command that allocates space lets you restrict where the space is allocated by adding the PVs and extent ranges to the end. So if you say lvcreate, on the end of lvcreate command line, you can specify the PV and the ranges of extents to use. And it just treats it like a set. It says, here's all the space in my volume group. I can't use this space because it's already allocated. And it then says, I can also only use the space that you've listed here. So it's just the intersection of the available space with the space there. That's quite a dangerous one. It's a bit controversial, is that one. Remove missing. If you use it the wrong way, as some people do, it destroys data that they didn't really want destroying. The reporting tools, so a quick example there, LVs-O plus devices will show you where the LVs have been allocated. You can see all the segment information and everything. And the syntax is copied from PS, where you can list the fields, -o, you give the list. And it's useful for scripting, basically. You can sort on fields. You don't have to display the field you're sorting on. You can specify the units. You can say, I want my space in multiples of 700 bytes, please. So it'll divide all your space by 700 bytes and tell you how many multiples of 700 bytes. It'll do that for you if you want. So I definitely recommend looking at the man pages for these commands. Lots of configuration options. Again, they're reasonably well documented in the example file and the man page. Tagging is a partial solution to what I was saying earlier about labeling the mirrors and the mirrored space and the fast disks. You can apply tags to devices now. A tag is just a string. And then that string can be used as a selector in all the other commands. So if you have 5 logical volumes, you could tag 2 logical volumes with the tag file systems and the other 3 with the tag databases. And then you could say lvchange-ay tag databases, and it will activate only the ones that you tagged as database logical volumes and not the file system ones. And it's consistent because the tools use a single binary and a single way of single place for parsing everything. Anywhere that takes a logical volume will take a logical volume tag, or it'll take a volume group. If it takes a volume group, it expands it to all the logical volumes in there. So you've got add tag and del tag for doing those, and display tools again. You've also got host tags, which I haven't time to show now, but this is mainly for clustering, or if you're replicating configurations between machines. It will mean the same file can have a different effect on different machines based on the host name. So you can have one configuration file. And use that control to control what is activated where. Okay, so just going on to the very last bit now. The roadmap for device mapper. Because we're in the kernel track, I thought I ought to say a bit more on the kernel. These are the sorts of things that are coming up on device mapper in the kernel. And if I take, these are fairly boring on that slide. But more interesting ones, trying to minimize the time the device is suspended, so that because a sync is quite slow, so we need a better way of doing that. Letting non-root users use some of the ioctls, so you can delegate database administration to your database admins without giving them root access. Replacing the event mechanism Heinz mentioned earlier with Netlink. A target that calls out to user space, that was posted on DM Devel quite recently, maybe quite controversial, but it will call out to user space to decide where to map the I.O. RAID level Heinz has been working on a target for finding where your I.O. hotspots are. So you take your disk and divide it up into equal size chunks and monitor how much I.O. goes into each of the chunks. Then after a fixed period of time, you find which chunk had the most I.O. and you divide that one up into smaller pieces, whereas the other ones which didn't have much I.O., you join those together and make them bigger. So over a period of time, it homes in on the areas of the disk where you've got most I.O. and reports that back to you. Another one with snapshots. If you have the writable snapshot, you say that you might want to be able to commit those changes back to your original device. And so we're doing some work at the moment to allow that, as long as you haven't changed your origin. So this lets you fork your system and decide later whether you want to keep the fork change or you want to revert to the original. And then there's some work going on with mirroring as well. Lots of multipath stuff has been talked about. Clustering. And links to various sites, which are very similar to the links Heinz posted earlier. So that's my hour. If you have any questions, it's probably best to just chat to me outside or find me later. So I don't think we've time for any questions now. So thank you.